It's the Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Do you know that pistachio nuts actually make a sound when they ripen? It's a single moment when they finally grow that extra bit and they burst their skins and shells. Susan Loomis writes about it in her book on nuts. She says in Syria, farmers listen for tiny puffs of air, little poofs. And those puffs sweep from tree to tree across orchards. In one night, acres of nuts can open up. Susan calls it pistachio music. Well, stay with us. There's much more coming your way this hour on The Splendid Table. This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 75,000 downloadable titles. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/splendidtable.
This week's Splendid Table is a repeat of an earlier broadcast.
This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Wine lovers who live for the next great sip usually go into mourning during the summer. The big serious wines do not get on with heat and humidity. The thought of a 99-rated Cabernet next to a grilled steak may be enticing, but if it is 99 in the shade with humidity to match, that cab is going to flatten you. So what can stand in for those big guys? Food & Wine magazine's executive wine editor, Ray Isle, is always the man with the answers, so I think I'm going to put him on the spot. Ray, good to have you back.
Lynn, hi. Good to be back.
Okay, so what could stand in for that Cabernet?
Well, you know, there's a lot of things that could stand in, but kind of going counterintuitively, you can actually pour some pretty nice red wines in the summer with a chill on them, which is, you know, I think an interesting twist on what people expect. If you stay away from wines that are big and tannic and intense like Cabernets and head more towards the Beaujolais side, those are wines that, you know, really do have the kind of oomph to go with a roast chicken or even a steak, but at the same time, you can drop them down to, you know, 50, 55 degrees, and they're nice and refreshing and crisp. You know, people forget about Beaujolais. They think of the whole thing as being Beaujolais Nouveau, and I would say
right. Forget
Beaujolais Nouveau. Just put it out of your mind, besides especially because it came out in November and it's not – you don't want to drink it in the summer. The Cru Beaujolais, the one from the towns, the sort of special towns in Beaujolais, Morgon, Moulin-Avant, Julianas.
So they'll be on the label.
Exactly. And those are, I think, some of the best deals out there in the wine world. You know, Georges Dubuff is kind of the big producer that everybody knows, and his Cru Beaujolais are quite nice. And a couple of others like Chateau Thivin and Marcel Lapierre. If you can find Lapierre anywhere, just buy it immediately. It's great stuff. But those are fantastic food wines, and they're – you know, they've got enough richness to go with pretty much anything, but they're at the same time, they aren't hugely tannic and they aren't heavy and they aren't weighty and, the you know, kind of keep you moving in the summer.
You know, it's so interesting you say that because people don't drink them as much as they used to. It's sort of Pinot Noir took over and they're not expensive. Am I remembering?
No, I mean, most of these are under $20 and often under like the $12, $13 zone. And that's, you know, it's hard to find really interesting, complex, fascinating wines at that price point. You can find, you know, quaffable, drinkable stuff. But
right.
I think some of the best Beaujolais are well worth paying attention to.
Okay. Now, this is my big question. Can you break me of my Sauvignon Blanc dependency?
You know, I don't know if I should. I'm perfectly fond of Sauvignon Blanc. I hate to do it a disservice, but I think I can, actually. And I would push you towards what's become my sort of favorite summer grape, white wine grape right now, which is Albariño from Spain. Albariño comes out of the sort of northwest corner of Spain, Galicia, which is – it's not like, you know, you think of Spain as being Ferdinand the Bull and bullfights and dust and all
right,
that. And Galicia is green and verdant and misty and much more like – it actually feels like Ireland to some degree, except if you're speaking Spanish.
Right.
But Albarino is this crisp, intense sort of citrus plus mineral white wine that it doesn't have the grassiness that Sauvignon Blanc sometimes has that, you know, shifts up to green pepper.
Yeah,
it's just clear and crisp, and it's like the ultimate seafood wine, which isn't that surprising because Galicia's main business is seafood.
That's right, because it's right on the coast.
Yeah, it's right on the coast. Fabulous oysters and mussels and things like that. And Albarino, you know, it's anywhere from, you know, $12 a bottle on up to 22 or so. And I just think it's fantastic summer wine. I have an article coming out in our July issue about it. And I said in the article, it's like, I wish that the New York Parks Department would install water fountains that dispensed Albarino during the summer. It'd make everybody thrilled.
They'd also make everybody so happy.
It would, but, you know, I don't think the budget's there for it somehow.
You know, one of the things, is this a vegetable-friendly wine? Because one of the things that happens in the summer, I think, is that we really go crazy for vegetables.
I mean, Albarino is a fantastic vegetable-friendly wine. That realm of what you would call sort of aromatic white wines, non-oaked aromatic white wines, they tend to be aged in stainless steel, tend to be crisp and bright, very light. Those tend to be the go-to vegetable wines. Albarino, Sauvignon Blanc, Grüner Veltliner from Austria, Vermentino, let's say, from Italy. Those are all kind of terrific vegetable wines, but terrific green salad wines too. And it's hard to match, you know, it's not so much the salad as the vinaigrette that's tricky.
Mm-hmm.
But what you want is a wine with like a little zing of acidity of its own to match up with a vinaigrette.
How about bubblies? Cheap, good bubblies for summer?
Cheap, good bubblies for summer.
Yeah,
I'm pointing people these days towards Prosecco. I think, you know, it's inexpensive. You know, you can get good Prosecco for $10, $12 a bottle, even less in some cases, down under 10. And it's got a lightheartedness to it. It's, you know, it's fresh and crisp and a little bit, you know, just got that little fruity lemon, lime, melon sweetness to it. And it's not sugary sweet. It's just got fruit sweetness. And
right.
It's just kind of that wine you take a sip and it makes you happy and you aren't concerned with what you paid for it because you didn't pay very much and the sun is out and, you know, the water is, you know, people are splashing around in pools and it just seems like the ideal wine for it. I think, you know, one of my favorites is Nino Franco, which is, you know, probably about $15 a bottle. And then Mionetto is easy to find and everywhere and it's quite nice as well.
Mm-hmm. And it's fabulous with spicy food. Ray, thanks for talking with us.
My pleasure. Always happy to come on.
Ray Isle is the executive wine editor for Food & Wine magazine. And those summer wines he talked about, well, you can find them on the website, splendidtable.org. Now, that Spanish white Ray was mentioning, the Albarino, well, you know, this is the wine that tastes, as Ray said, of citrus and apricot and minerals. It always kind of reminds me of wet stones. It works really well with seafood starchy dishes like rice, things like grilled chicken, and believe it or not, Japanese dishes and Vietnamese spring rolls. But how about thinking about a rice salad improv with new peas? This is what you do. Boil the rice just like pasta in a big pot of water, and you could tint the water yellow with some of what I think of as poor man's saffron. That's turmeric. And by the way, don't add too much because it ends up tasting like chalk. While the rice is hot, toss it with a little sweet Spanish paprika. Add the peas, they could be sugar snaps, and maybe some cooked seafood. And then add lots of chives and scallion tops and a little lemon and olive oil. The salad's an improv, but if you want a written recipe to work from, there's several rice salad recipes on the website. You know where that is, splendidtable.org. Wine may be complicated, but I think fish beats it out these days. You have to figure out now what is sustainable, what's ecologically sound, and then you have to think about contamination. I mean, take tuna, for instance. Do you know that there are 31 different names for the 5 or 6 different species of tuna? Well, one of the places to go for answers is the Monterey Bay Aquarium. They run the Seafood Watch program. Seafood Watch gathers information from all over the world on ecological situations with fish. And we've got the Seafood Watch outreach manager with us, Sheila Bowman. Sheila, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Sheila, we've got a long list of questions about tuna.
You know, Lynn, tuna is a pretty complex food for us. We get a lot of questions about it. It's one of the top fish that we eat in this country, so people are very interested. Like anything else, it's really a question of knowing what you're eating and making good choices.
Okay. Let's talk tuna in a can. First of all, should we be eating tuna in a can?
You know, we eat a lot of it in this country, and it's one of the fish that kids really start kind of, as youngsters, we all ate tuna. We like tuna that in the can that's either the skipjack or the albacore, the light tuna, or the sometimes called white tuna.
Right.
As, you know, what we don't really like is we're starting to see tongal tuna and some of these other species canned that are not as sustainable. So stick with the light and the white. It's a better choice. Again, you know, there's issues with it, but it's there on our yellow list. It's a good alternative.
Are we supposed to be eating tuna at sushi bars?
Well, you know, one of the things, as we all know, that you're going to encounter at the sushi bar is that bluefin tuna.
Right.
Sometimes sold as toro. It's that just fabulous fatty meat. And that's the one we really are saying that people should, without a question, stay away from. Highly endangered in, you know, throughout the world's oceans, and it's one we really need to give a break to. And we're talking now, not, you know, it's something to do in the future. It's one that needs us, our help right now.
Okay. And so is there a particular kind of tuna that we should look for in that
situation?
Well,
you know, one of the most, you know, sustainable fish that you can get at the sushi bar would be an albacore tuna.
Mm-hmm.
Something that's called shiro maguro when you go in. That's one to certainly ask for. Your basic yellowfin tuna, which we all know is ahi, that's another choice that you can look for in the sushi bar. Skipjack isn't one that's there a lot, but it's certainly a great fish that could be served in a sushi bar. So It's really a lot, Lynn, about kind of saying, I'm not interested in the bluefin. What other tunas can you offer me? And, you know, if there's any adventurous eaters in the world, it's got to be the sushi bar crowd.
Yes, that's true. That's
so
true.
If they, you know, if they can go out on a limb and try something new, you know, that's a really great way to increase demand and start shifting those sushi bars towards these other species.
Right. All right. Now the other big question, mercury, because we hear that canned tuna, tuna in general, and many other fish have mercury. So what about mercury levels?
Well, that is. I mean, I think that's one of the real concerns when you start talking about tuna. And when we direct you towards the troll or the pole-caught tuna, now I'm not sure if that's mostly a West Coast thing, but those are smaller fish. And literally in the world of mercury, the bigger you are, the more time you've had to accumulate through your diet these contaminants like mercury. So the big fish are the ones that you want to stay away from if you are feeding children. You know, we do have those indications on our website and on our pocket guides, but it is another reason to sort of walk away from bluefin and some of these other really large fish.
This is really complicated stuff, isn't it?
It's pretty complicated, but, you know, I think since we're speaking tuna, it's a great chance to talk about how things have changed in the last 5 years because mm-hmm. the tuna industry is hearing from us, and you are starting to see alternatives out there. And I know in my market, I'm starting to see the troll pole cod, and that is a premium product that's completely sustainable, and that's what we should all be looking for.
Do you eat tuna on a regular basis?
I do not. You know, I used to, and it's just one of the species that I've decided personally is not going to be on my menu anymore. I just feel like it's one that needs a break, needs mm-hmm. time to rebuild, and I've shifted away from that one.
Well, Sheila Bowman, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Sheila Bowman is Outreach Manager of Seafood Watch at the Monterey Bay Aquarium. Now, for information on the buying guide she mentioned, just go to the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're on the site, sign up for our free e-newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen, and get registered for our monthly book giveaway. Now, this month, it's The Japanese Grill by Tadashi Ono and Harris Salat. Sign up to win at splendidtable.org. Coming up, Making Food Irresistible, the Hidden Career of the Food World. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the Internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 75,000 downloadable titles. For a free audiobook of your choice, including In Defense of Food by Michael Pollan or Four Fish by Paul Greenberg, go to audiblepodcast.com/splendidtable. This is The Splendid Table from APM American Public Media. It's the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Sexy beauties. You've got Angelina Jolie, you've got Beyonce, and you've got that burger in the ad that made you so hungry you hit the drive-thru. So Angelina's and Beyonce's secret weapons are makeup artists, but what about that come-hither burger? Well, it had a food stylist, one of those hidden careers in the food world. Every time you see food in media, there is a highly trained pro behind it, and it's the food stylist. Well, we've got a master with us today. Dolores Custer teaches styling all over the world, and she has done The Professional's Guide. It's a magnum opus called Food Styling, The Art of Preparing Food for the Camera. Dolores, welcome.
Thank you, Lynn. It's my pleasure, too.
So what does a stylist do?
A food stylist is a person that gets food ready for the camera, and it can be any kind of camera. I get foods ready for cookbooks, for magazine articles. I get foods ready for commercials, for ads, for movies. We're the makeup people for food.
Now, is it a very different kind of job when you're working, let's say, for something that's going to appear in a movie compared to something that's going to appear in, for argument's sake, an advertisement?
Yeah, very different. Each medium has their own things that they want. When we work with magazines, they want it to be very natural, very real, and relating to their audience. And each magazine has a different audience. When we shoot an ad, the food has to be their food. That's truth in advertising. But, of course, they want it presented as beautifully as possible. When we work in movies, we don't even go on the set. We hand it to a prop master. But when I was working on Trading Places, I was teaching one of the actors how to make crepes, which he ended up throwing in the garbage can. That was part of the script. One of the joys of this job is that we get into situations that we never imagined we would be. You know, I never thought that I would be spreading margarine in the tropical forests of Mexico.
How did you come to spread margarine in the tropical forests of Mexico?
It was for a commercial. And we had our hero swinging from the vines, you know, there was a beautiful treehouse that they built for the commercial. And there I was up in the treehouse spreading margarine on bread.
I can't believe it's not butter.
You might have seen it. Yes, you're absolutely right.
Now, because I've seen food stylists work, I mean, you guys usually arrive with a toolkit that makes a fisherman's kit look like they're rank amateurs. And you've got shopping bags up the kazoo, and you usually come in teams, and you work for hours before a photographer ever, you know, snaps a picture. What's the background you have to do this?
Well, we have to be really good cooks and bakers. Absolutely. We have to be strong physically because, as you said, we're schlepping all those bags. We're standing there all day. I think a lot of people, you know, think, ooh, what a glamorous job you must have. then when they meet the reality that we're standing over a deep fat fryer frying chicken for a commercial for 13 hours, you know, then they go, oh. And one of my mentors said, food is like children. It doesn't like to behave in front of company. And our company is the photographer, the cameraman, the whomever. Ice cream melts, our garnishes wilt, the lettuce wilts, things get tired looking, the sauce gets a skin on the top of it or doesn't look bright and fresh. We have to know how to make coffee look like it was just poured. So some of it is scientific information. Other parts are just, you know, working with the food and figuring out how we can make things happen with it when it needs to, when it's going to have its picture taken.
So can you kind of give me an example?
Well, let's take a hamburger. If we're doing an advertising hamburger, they want sort of a perfect look. We're going to shoot it looking right into the hamburger. And we'll start by finding a perfect bun. We may sort through 100 of them to find this perfect bun. If they have sesame seeds, we may add sesame seeds just exactly where we need them. And we use a little Elmer's glue and a toothpick and or a tweezer. Then if there are grill marks on the hamburger, we'll add grill marks. And since we're shooting at eye level, we'll go over the edge just a little bit so that you can see them. To melt the cheese, we use singles, American craft singles or whatever, mm-hmm. and we dip it into some boiling water. And then we put it down on top of the hamburger. And right before we shoot, I brush the edge of the hamburger with just a little, very light vegetable oil. And that gives it a little glisten.
All that.
All that for a hamburger.
Mm-hmm. Dolores, thanks for talking with us.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
Food stylist Dolores Custer has written Food Styling, the Art of Preparing Food for the Camera. Now, for a dish that's quite beautiful on its own, check out the recipe New York Times food writer Melissa Clark left us a while back. It's for a blender borscht with dill and cream. It's beautiful and it tastes fabulous. Susan Loomis is a food writer and cooking teacher who lives in France, and she teaches in her home there. But recently, she practically went around the world to get firsthand material for her book on nuts. It's called Nuts in the Kitchen, and I've got Susan on the phone from her home. Hey, Susan, good to talk to you.
Well, it's great to be here, and I'm thrilled.
Susan, you know, I want to talk about what I think of as the most underappreciated nut, the pistachio.
Oh, my God. I love pistachios. And I went to a huge effort to travel to where see the germplasm of the pistachio.
And where is that?
That's in a place, it's in eastern Anatolia in Turkey. And it all centers around a town that's called Gaziantep. And I literally, when I started doing this book, that was one of the main places I wanted to go because I love pistachio.
Is this literally where they began?
You know, I was out in the field, in the orchard, with a Turkish pistachio specialist, a man who lives and breathes for pistachios. And he looked at me and said, "We are standing on the germplasm of the pistachio." So, yes, that's where they began.
Oh, my.
It was a moment.
Do they come from a bush or do they come from a tree?
Oh, they're so beautiful. They come from a tree. They're very small trees, and they're quite tortured looking because they have to work hard to get water and nutrients.
Uh-huh.
But they're very beautiful. They're perfectly proportioned in the sense that they have a kind of a large canopy, you know, the top part, and
yeah.
on this beautiful, graceful trunk. And their leaves are velvety. And their bark is silvery. And I swear, when you touch it, it's warm. Like, it feels like a person.
Sounds quite romantic.
It is romantic.
Did you have a chance to taste them right off the tree?
I did.
What are they? Do they taste different than what we get?
You know what they taste like is brown butter. You know, when you cook butter so it's just golden and it gets that little nutty flavor, that's exactly what they taste like. And the thing is, they harvest them in several different stages, immature, a little more mature, and then fully mature. And I was tasting one that was middle maturity. So it had that soft butteriness to it.
If they harvest them at different stages, is each stage then marketed a different way or used a different way?
Well, the very young ones, they're almost embryonic, and they're bright, bright green. They are really the green that gives the pistachio green. That's why pistachio green is called that.
Right.
It's the immature nut. And most of those go directly to sweet makers in and around Gaziantep because that area of the world is known for its baklava and its, you know, all these wonderful pastries made with this green gold. They're mm-hmm. terribly expensive.
Mm-hmm.
And I would imagine pastry makers can get them, and we can probably get them, but they are not widely marketed.
When we buy pistachios, what should we be looking for?
Well, we should be looking for the pistachios from Turkey. They're very slender. they've got a pale ivory shell, a little darker than what we're used to, and they should be slightly open at the end because they do that when they're on the tree, and that signals that they're ripe. There's a big kind of a bulbous fat variety with a very, very pale shell that comes from Iran, and there are also some grown in California. To me, to my palate, that is the less desirable pistachio. You really want the slender, darker one.
Now, aren't they usually roasted before we get them?
They are usually roasted, unless you're buying them just the kernel, and then they're raw, and then you have to roast them yourself. But you can do that easily, even in a pan on top of the stove. You can just put a little oil on them, and you can put pistachio oil on them, a little bit of salt, and saute them for about 4 minutes.
That's a great idea. All right, this leads to my other question. Where do nuts belong? Should they be on the counter, should they be in the refrigerator, or should they be in the freezer?
If you're planning to keep them for longer than a week or so, they should be in the freezer. When I buy nuts, I put them directly in the freezer in plastic containers, so they're really airtight. I always also have a jar on my counter that are toasted and salted, but that's for eating.
Right. Now, using pistachios, I mean, people think of them in sweets and that kind of thing. But what are some of the things we may not have thought of in terms of how to use them?
Well, the French are wonderful about them, and they mix them in with ground pork to use in pâtés. So lots of times you'll cut into a pâté here, and you'll have these bright pistachios blinking up at you from the pâté. They're often used in a stuffing. I've got a recipe where they're in a pork loin with apricots. They can be used really in any sauce, a savory sauce. You can sprinkle them on top of a soup or toss them into a salad at the last minute. They're very versatile.
You know, I'm just thinking that brown butter taste, maybe with a salad of orange sections, that combination would probably be pretty swell.
Well, pistachios are so widely used in the Middle East, and there they're often combined with dried or fresh fruit. So that's a really great idea. You can also use them with pomegranate seeds and as a garnish on something, and they're colorful and gorgeous. Mm. And, you know, in California, where there is a small production of pistachio, you can buy pistachio butter.
You can make that yourself, right?
You can make any nut butter, and I think people should eat more nut butter. You know, if you have that on hand, you can thicken sauces with it, and it's wonderful.
I'm going to do this. I'm going to do this. Susan, thanks so much.
Lynn, thank you. It was a pleasure.
Susan Loomis is author of Nuts in the Kitchen. Now, she left us with a recipe from the homeland of the pistachio. It's potatoes with yogurt and pistachio nuts. And it's on the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, take a look at the Splendid Table store, where you can find products related to cooking and baking.
Okay, I'm ready now.
Business travel is so much fun these days. You deserve a good meal on the road, which means you need Jane and Michael Stern and their site, roadfood.com. Jane, Michael, welcome.
Great to be here.
Hi, Lynn.
So where have you been?
We have been in Cleveland eating Polish boys.
All right, okay. Wait a minute.
Do you want
right
me to
away,
explain?
Right away, I think it's Michael has found yet another form of the great hot dog.
No, you're kind of right, Lynn. It is a tube steak. It is in that family. It's really a kielbasa, though, like a big one. And what's unique about a Polish boy is that it's the kielbasa, but with barbecue sauce and French fries in a bun.
With
coleslaw, all in a bun, including the coleslaw, too.
And French fries.
Yes. It's everything in one bun, or at least in one big tray. It's a royal mess, and it's something that you find in that configuration only in Cleveland.
Now, the best place to eat this is at a restaurant called Hot Sauce Williams, which is kind of a little barbecue with a smoker out back. And we had never really had these Cleveland-style barbecued kielbasas until our last trip to Cleveland.
Well, in fact, we had gone to Hot Sauce Williams for, as the name suggests, really good hot sauce. They're well known for ribs and pulled pork and all of the other things you'd expect at a barbecue. But we were told, you know, when you go to Hot Sauce Williams, be sure to eat a Polish boy. And like you, Lynn, when we first heard that, we said, what? And in fact, anyone in Cleveland knows what you're talking about. It's really a great idea. I mean, when you think of that garlicky goodness, that juicy succulence of a kielbasa cooked really taut and bursting with juice, topped with barbecue sauce.
Here we go again.
Well, okay. I'm sorry.
I know it's verging on the pornographic.
Well, but it sounds it's Michael loving tube steak. This is what it comes down
to.
I'm not ashamed. It's a really great version of the tube steak.
Yeah, and it occurred to me. I mean, of course, Cleveland. It's very Midwestern. I mean, isn't it? You know, we all know at this point that you grew up in Chicago.
Well,
land.
Yeah. Actually, Jane has an interesting point there, that one of the very lesser-known aspects of barbecues in urban Midwest is the importance of sausages there. Because if you go to the south side of Chicago and go to Lem's or Leon's or Barbara Ann's or any of the really highly respected barbecue restaurants there, one of the items on the menu is what they call a hot link. Now, a hot link in Chicago is completely different from a hot link in Texas. In Texas, when you get a hot link, it's an all-beef sausage. In Chicago, it's an all-pork sausage, very coarsely ground, with the kind of spices you almost might expect in a breakfast sausage.
Michael?
And yet this...
This is the Michael Stern hot dog hour.
My sausage
No. I have to say, Michael, I see a PhD dissertation in your future. And I'd like you to check in with us periodically. But
right.
but for the moment, I'm just going to focus on that Polish sausage. And thank you both very, very
Bye,
much.
I'm going to go study. Thank you, Lynn.
Jane and Michael Stern are the authors of Road Food. Now, okay, it's time for this week's trivia challenge. And this week the question is, what plant has been named after food activist and writer Michael Pollan? We're going to be back with that answer and taking time to talk with you. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Now, we're going to be talking with you in a moment. You can join us at 800-537-5252. You can connect with us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, what kind of plant was named after food activist Michael Pollan? Well, it was a tomato, and it was not genetically engineered, and it's a pretty distinctive tomato. We found the skinny on the Annie's Annuals and Perennials website. The horticulturalist there, Kelly Kilpatrick, writes that the Michael Pollan tomato is an oddly shaped mutant related to the green zebra tomato, which means that Michael is mottled with yellow and green. Now, I have to say, the taste sounds boring. It's sweet and mild, and there is a problem. Michael Pollan is susceptible to blossom end rot. Hey, I mean, it could be a lot worse. And, Michael, we want to congratulate you.
Hello? Hey, what's going on? How come I never see you around no more? Where you been? Yeah, well, you should call me.
It is time for us to talk. You can reach us at 800-537-5252 or send an email, splendidtable.org. Anything you want to get into? Okay, let's see. We have got Danielle on the line from Salt Lake City. Danielle, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. I went and did a college program in Florida, and I had a Chinese roommate, and she was from one of the southern provinces. And I made a deal with her that if she shared me a delicacy from her country, I would share with her a delicacy from mine. Well, me being in college, I decided to give her top ramen. And she gave me, of course, some of the best dishes that I had ever tried. But she did it in such a unique way in using, you know, pig's ear and soy curd and you name it, she did it.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I'm just wondering, where can I go to get an authentic Chinese cookbook from that region, or just authentic Chinese cookbook in general? Because when I go to the Asian markets, most of the cookbooks are in Chinese. So they're very little help to me.
Yeah, they are. And by the way, you're going to find, even if you could translate them, many of them are written for people who already understand basics that are not necessarily familiar to us.
Right.
But there are two authors off the top of my head that are worth looking at.
Okay.
One is Eileen Yinfei Lo. She's just done a book that's come out recently, and I want to say it's The Art of Chinese Cooking. We had her on the show, in fact. But she's done other cookbooks. This woman is a fanatic about tradition, and I think she is originally from southern China. From the area that used to be called Canton, but she covers other regions. But her work is fanatical. She's a teacher by nature. She does teach cooking, but she's also a great traditionalist. The other person to check out is Grace Young.
Grace is
Chinese-American. And she did, I think, The Wisdom of the Chinese Kitchen, which is a wonderful book about her family. And then she did The Breath of a Wok, which is a fabulous book. If you look at just the work of those two women, I think you're going to find what you're looking for. And both of them write wonderful explanations.
Excellent.
I mean, if you want to know how to buy a wok, you must read the introduction and the material in Breath of a Wok by Grace Young. No one has written what she's written about a wok. And it's fabulous. And it's clear and it's simple. And yet it's the core. It's authentic down to its, you know, the last serif on the print. So those are two people to check out. And I think you're going to find what you're looking for.
All right. Thank you so much, Lynn. I really appreciate it.
You are welcome, Danielle. Have a great day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye. You can call us 800-537-5252 or send us an email, splendidtable.org. Jeff is on the line from Matunuck Beach, Rhode Island. Jeff, what do you want to talk about?
Well, then, since last fall, I've been renting a house that's located on a salt pond. And this salt pond is just full of quahogs.
The clams.
Those are the native Rhode Island clams. And because the salt pond is so close to the ocean, the water, it rises and falls with the tides. And during low tide, you can just walk out in about 2 feet of water and scoop up the clams and just get a big meal for yourself.
Oh, boy.
So in about 2 weeks, I'm having about 6 to 10 friends up, and it's also my last week in the house. So I was wondering if you have any creative clam recipes or ideas that could take the festivities up a notch.
Now, first of all, when you're describing being on a salt marsh, to me that's one of the most beautiful places you can be. I mean,
it's beautiful. It's got a little bit of land between the salt pond and the ocean.
Right.
So it's practically ocean, just without the waves.
Exactly. All right. This is the question. Now, the quahog, because as I said, it's been a long time for me since I've been on the East Coast. That's what we call the soft shell clam. It's the one with the sort of foot sticking out of it, right?
It's I think it's actually hard shell. It's
wait a minute.
The smaller ones they call cherry stones.
Oh, wait a minute. I know what you're talking about. These are the bigger ones.
Yes. The bigger ones I've been told are best in like a clam chowder. And the smaller ones we kind of steam and eat.
Yeah. I was raised on cherry stones and little necks on the Jersey Shore.
Okay. Oh, yeah.
I gotcha. Let me ask you this. Do you want to serve this to a bunch of people in a pot? You know what I'm saying? Sort of as something you would eat in a bowl. Or do you want to serve it in another way? Like, for instance, these babies minced up, okay, with some onion and a little bit of breadcrumb and garlic and a little bit of mayonnaise, almost the way you would do a crab cake, but mainly clam, pan-fried, are just to die for.
Oh, that sounds like it would hit the spot.
Yeah, but you'd have to be doing that kind of the last minute. You could grind them up a bit, like in a food processor.
Okay.
Okay. And then you'd add chopped onion. You would add a bit of breadcrumb, toasted breadcrumbs. Okay. Fresh toasted breadcrumbs so they're crunchy. And a bit of mayo. and a little bit of Tabasco if you'd like.
Oh, okay.
And then what you would do is you'd make them into little balls, and then you can dip them into a little beaten egg and then a little bit of more of those toasted breadcrumbs. You know what some people also use? They use crushed, believe it or not, crushed cornflakes. Lightly crushed cornflakes. And then you have about a half inch of oil in your skillet, and you just pan fry them.
Well, that sounds like a plan.
That could be a plan. Now, the other alternative is these are fabulous soup clams. And you could take them and get a lot of the natural clam juice, hold that off on the side. And then what you would do is you'd saute. Do you have access to shallots where you are?
Yes. Yes, okay. I do. There's some farmers markets around.
Okay. You want a little bit of salt pork.
Okay.
Which you would drop in boiling water for about 3 or 4 minutes to get rid of a lot of that salt. Dice it up. Sauté that in a deep pot with the shallots until the salt pork is kind of golden and a little crispy and the shallots are starting to pick up color. Pour into that a combination. If you can get dry apple cider, it's great. But if not, get apple cider and white wine, half and half. Pour that in. Boil it down to just about nothing. And then stir in the clams. Add the clam juice. Add a bit of water. And okay. More white wine, and just let that simmer. And you could throw into that some thyme, some bay leaf, even a couple of cut up very tart apples like Granny Smith.
Okay.
Cook it until it's tender, and then at the just before you serve it, you stir in a little cream, and you're there. And you can top it with just a little crunch of diced red onion. And you've got sort of a Normandy-style chowder.
And that would be great.
The other thing that can go in there is potatoes.
Oh, well, that sounds like a wonderful alternative to the kind of the typical cream-based
exactly.
Chowder.
And this should not be thick and gluey. It should be rather thin. With all of that clam in there, it's going to be really delicious.
Oh, wonderful. And I don't mind doing it last minute because I'm planning on having my friends come out and helping me catch them all.
Exactly. Put them to work. And enjoy the salt marsh for the next week. Oh, it sounds wonderful. It really does.
Thank you so much.
You are very welcome.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye, Jeff. Oh, does that bring back memories? Remember, you can send us an email, splendidtable.org, or you can call 800-537-5252. We got an email from Kevin in Memphis, and he wrote, "Recently I've been cooking for a group of people who do not drink alcohol. They enjoy good food from a variety of ethnic origins, but I would like to add to the dinner with a variety of drink pairings other than the standard iced tea or soda. So my question is this, what are the factors in choosing a drink to match certain food?" Well, the same thing that applies in pairing wine with food applies to pairing any other beverage with food. You either complement the taste of the food with a similar kind of taste, or you contrast. So let me give you an instance. Let's say you're doing really, really hot and spicy Thai food. Well, what would be great with that would be something that is very crisp, okay, a hint of spice, and a lot of tartness, because it would kind of cut through all of that spiciness. So you'd make fresh ginger tea, and then you would do a lot of fresh lime juice in that, pour it over ice, and then add some sparkling water to it. And you could add a little agave syrup or sugar to sweeten it up. Now, barbecue, you could also approach that way. Either you have something that's sweet, like maybe mango with a little bit of chili in it and a lot of fresh lemon, or you could imitate beer. And how do you do that? Well, you do essentially a sparkling lemonade. And again, I would add something really piquant to it, like a little shot of Tabasco, just to have it really sing. And again, you know, just like beer is tart and very fizzy, well, so is a really tart lemonade or limeade that you do with a bubbly water. So there's the basic idea, and it applies no matter what kind of drink you're having. Call us, 800-537-5252, or go online, splendidtable.org. We've got Chelsea calling from Omaha. Hey, Chelsea, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. Thanks for taking my call.
Oh, you're welcome, Chelsea.
So I'm getting married, and my fiance and I were doing kind of the registry thing recently.
Right.
And neither of us have lived on our own, so we were feeling kind of overwhelmed because we kind of need everything.
Oh, yeah.
So I was wondering if there's, like, some kitchen essential that I might not have thought of.
Okay, let me see. Well, you know what I think? I think one thing that you're really going to find you use a lot, and this would be a registry item. It's not inexpensive, but it's really I use it all the time. A 12-inch straight-sided sauté pan. Yeah, because this is what you make a sauce in. You can quickly pan brown, you know, a couple of chicken breasts. You can saute vegetables in it. It's almost a cross between a stew pot and a frying pan and a saute pan. And if it has a metal handle, it can be your roasting pan and you put it in the oven. It's the all-in-one pan. And the kind that you want is lined with stainless steel. And then the outside has a thick aluminum layer going all the way up the sides.
Wow.
And it's going to be about $150, $120. But this is one pan. I have mine 30 years. It will never die. And you will use it constantly. The other thing, if that's not in the cards, is a 12-inch cast iron skillet. Because you can do a ton of stuff in it. You can also use it as a roasting pan. And they're like $20. Is that the kind of thing you're thinking about?
Yeah, those sound excellent, actually. Wait, can I ask you one more question?
Oh, absolutely.
We recently got some silver-plated silverware. Can you use that for everyday occasions? Or is that more of a, like, once-a-week type of silverware?
You know, my mother had silver plate, and she had silver. And the silver plate was her everyday stuff.
Okay.
Use it. Enjoy it. Do you, I mean, between you and me, do you like it?
I love it.
You love it? Then you should use it. Use it every single day. It will. It'll make you feel better. You know what I mean?
Right.
So you think about, you know, either the cast iron skillet or think about that big skillet. That big skillet you're going to do a lot with. And if you look at any of the recipes on our website, any with my name on them at least, you're going to see that skillet used constantly. Hey, congratulations to the two of you.
Thank you very much, Lynn.
Goodbye, Chelsea.
All right, bye-bye.
By the way, if you've got silver plate, a lot of people claim you shouldn't put it in the dishwasher. Well, I followed my mother's model. And by the way, I'm using her silver plate. So it's 30 years old and it's been going into the dishwasher for a very, very long time. So I think you're not going to have any problem keeping silver plate. Call us 800-537-5252. Or you can go online, shoot us an email, splendidtable.org. Well, in the wilds of Brooklyn, New York, there is an unsung heroine, the Jell-O Mold Mistress of Brooklyn. She's Victoria Bellinger, and we've got her on the phone. Victoria, good to have you with us.
Hi, Lynn.
So how did you become the Jell-O Mold Mistress of Brooklyn? I love that title.
Thank you. I was looking for a creative outlet in addition to my regular day job.
What is your day job?
I'm a forensic photographer.
Oh, I can understand where the Jell-O would be great to work with.
Complete departure with the Jell-O. I just needed something that was totally different, totally fun and innocent. And I was looking to bring something different to backyard barbecues and parties other than, you know, the typical coleslaw or potato salad that people were bringing or a bottle of wine. I realized that you can just sort of do just about anything with it. So I sort of started experimenting with different molds and different ingredients and using alcohol in them, which people, you know, really liked. And it made
them
more
popular. It always helps, doesn't it?
Yeah. So from there, I just, people liked it. I started bringing them to parties, and I think people were skeptical at first, but once they tried them, they liked them and encouraged me to try more things and just sort of took off.
So what was the first one you tried?
It was a vodka tonic, actually, with blueberries. And I put blueberries in it only because I happened to have some. And I brought it to this party, and people thought it was great. They'd never seen anything like it before. I never really tasted anything like it. So then I went and started buying some real molds and taking it from there.
So where are you now with this?
Well, it's sort of exploded. I started a blog, you know, a few months after I started making the Jell-Os, because I was photographing each one before they got eaten, because I feel like some of them were very structural and very pretty. So I wanted to record all of them, so I started the blog and put everything up there, and then I started getting a lot of traffic, and a lot of other bloggers were noticing it, and
it got really big. Then I had an article in the New York Times, which was sort of crazy. Yeah. And I had no idea that people even cared, but they do. And so now I'm potentially working on a book deal. I don't want to brag about something that hasn't happened yet, but I'm hoping.
But it sounds like you're giving Jell-O a whole new redo.
That's the idea. I feel like the attitude is that Jell-O is something that's for little kids, or, you know, it's just this undesirable dessert, and why would you eat Jell-O in a world of cupcakes and gelatos? But I'm trying to give it a fresh look and, a little bit more creative with it, a little bit more adult flavors, and have it be this, beautiful sculpture that you can then dive into and eat.
Well, I think the next thing we're going to be seeing is pictures of your creations on the back of the Jell-O box.
That would be great. A little endorsement.
Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you.
Take care.
Bye.
Bye. Victoria Bellinger is the Jell-O mold mistress of Brooklyn, and she left us with a recipe for peaches and cream Jell-O with schnapps. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us, and remember, you can call us anytime. The number's 800-537-5252. You have a great weekend. Let me leave you with this thought from Anonymous, who said, "Raising teenagers is like nailing Jell-O to the wall." The Splendid Table is produced by American Public Media. You'll find information on nearly everything you heard here today on our website, splendidtable.org. And also at splendidtable.org is the Splendid Table store, where you can find products related to cooking and baking. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Shubha Bala and Judy Boudreau. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. The website is managed by Sarah Lear. Our managing producer is Sally Swift. We'll be back next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.